I'm going to do a bit of a survey of fraud and abuse today. My name is Ellen Cram Kowalczyk, and I run a team within Trustworthy Computing Security focused on anti-customer harming fraud and abuse. So this is fraud and abuse that instead of just going after Microsoft's bottom line, also ends up causing our customers a lot of pain and ends up causing them to make choices like moving to our competitors or possibly even staying offline. So, when I say security, if you look at the topics that have been shared, you know, looking back 10 years at security conferences, even at the early Blue Hats, what you see is that security was primarily code security. It was buffer overruns, integer overflows, lots and lots of interesting attacks, but all of these attacks were fundamentally based on the code, primarily in box products. But over the last few years, as the world has moved online and everything has moved to services, we're seeing an entirely different realm of security. And so today I'm going to go over a little bit about what security looks like to our customers now that the focus isn't just on code security. So how many of you have seen any of the Broad Street work, the SURF from last year, any of this graph before? Anyone? See, there are people in this room who have seen the graph before. Cool. So this started as a project where we said, I wonder how malware gets onto people's machines. And of course, there were all these people who came and said, well, we all know how malware gets on people's machines. It's O-Day. And we took a look at it. We're like, well, we should go find out exactly how malware does get on people's machines. And it turns out the answer is not O-Day. The first, actually, chart like this we came out with had the USB autorun as even larger. And that's because except for Windows 7, which was the latest version at the time, auto-run for USB worked. So somebody gave you a random USB key at a conference, the first thing you did is plug it in, and it looked at it and said, hi, you're part of my system now, and I'll run your auto-run. Turns out lots and lots of malware was actually getting spread that way. We thought it was O-Day. It turned out to be cute little USB keys being given out at conferences and left in parking lots and such. So we did some work to go through and ship an update to turn that off by default. However, what we actually see as the even larger issue in this is social engineering. Now, classically, a lot of times we look at this and go, well, that's because social engineering is the customer's problem. It's not our problem. And so one of the things I'm going to talk about today is that social engineering is becoming our problem, whether we like it or not. So the news. Mark just went over a bunch of news stories. I get up in the morning and I go read scam news and cybercrime news because it's fun and I don't want to get out of bed because it's cold. But if you look at what is affecting things these days, it's things like major data breaches. You know, I go send my taxes in and now my social security number has been breached. There was a breach at the University of Washington recently and I was just talking to one of the people who works at Blue Hat and she's like, yeah, I was faculty at UW at the time. My information has probably been disclosed. Who has it gone to? Am I at risk? I honestly don't know. I didn't find out much. I just basically wake up, you know, slightly in fear. There are scams all over the place. You know, don't click on that thing on Facebook. Don't click on that attachment. Don't do this. Don't do that. It gets to a point where people fundamentally don't know what to do. So some data. 300,000 complaints to the IC3, which is a government organization. It's going up every year. $485 million, the average loss was $4,000. How many of you are all good with losing $4,000 this year to fraud? How many people does that bankrupt? How many people does that mean they don't make next month's rent? It's a really, really big deal. Law firms were losing $100,000 a piece. And we're seeing law firms, yeah, there's a total of one guy managed to get out, or is it $29 million. So it's a really, really big deal. We're not talking about, you know, like a $20 charge on your credit card. We're talking about a lot of money for people. So why is this such a problem? I mean, fraud and abuse have existed for as long as, you know, people have existed. Why is it such a big deal now? Well, there are a bunch of different things. The first one is scalability. If you look at the old school scams, you know, in the 20s and such, if I have to come up to you and I have to make friends and I have to get to know you and I have to slowly work you into a scam and I can only do that with one person at a time, that's an incredible amount of investment. However, I can send a million emails with just one touch of a button and somebody is going to respond. Customization, part of the reason that they're going to respond is I've used their name. Maybe I've, you know, been able to write some bots to go find out some basic information about people. There was a contest on Twitter a while back where basically you had to create a bot and see how many actual friends and stuff you could get, basically convincing the world that you were real. And these bots were amazing. You know, they were responding, they were talking to people. People really thought they had friends. The customization you can do automatically is amazing. Reach. You can reach people wherever they are. You know, I come home from work, I lock the door to make sure no bad things come in. I pour myself a glass of scotch, I get online, I'm sleepy, I'm not paying that much attention. I think of myself as safe because my doors are locked, but I'm not thinking that everything could be getting in through my computer. My daughter's using my computer, I have no idea what she's clicking. It's an entirely different world, and we haven't really come to a place where we get that. And a lot of that is that technology speed. You know, I learned a lot of the safety things I learned, you know, from my parents, from my teachers in school, but the way technology is moving, it's moving so fast that we don't have a lot of the models that we'd need in place to have people stay secure. You know, they kind of know, like, if some random person comes to the door, there's some checking they should do. But online is all brand new to people. And then feature abuse. So the cool thing with code security is, in many cases, we can take a look and say, oh, that's a bug. We'll go fix the bug, we'll ship a patch. But what happens when the very feature that is what the product is, that makes the product cool, that makes it something that people would want to buy, is the thing that's being abused? And we're not able to turn off the capability without hurting our existing customers. It's why it took us so long, actually, to turn off USB. There are some really amazing scenarios that come from, I take a USB key and I plug it in. On the other hand, it's also a really good way to get malware. And so because of that, you know, we were on a trade-off where we're really trying to decide how much of a feature do we give up in order to make sure that we do the right thing for security. And then you start looking at where are these things coming from. And you start looking at things like, it's really hard for us to trace where an issue came from. It could be coming from anywhere across the world. And in some of these cases, the governments of these countries have bigger problems than, you know, somebody tried to scam some American out of like $30. You know, they've got murders, they've got unrest. This is the last thing that they need to be worried about. Plus, you have economic inequality. This one is interesting. How many of you have heard about the scams where somebody calls and says, hi, I'm from Microsoft and I want to help you with your computer? Has anybody here gotten one? Yep. What kind of economic model makes sense for somebody to spend an hour with you on the phone in order to get maybe a couple $100 out of you? Well, if you think about it here, you could probably still work at McDonald's and get something similar, but that's not true all over the world. Plus, there are organized groups about these things, or even places where I was talking to somebody who works with the Nigerian scams, and they said, one of the things that happened in Nigeria is that basically it was a well-known rumor throughout the country that if somebody lost money through a Nigerian scam, that it was just replaced by the US government anyway, so they weren't doing any harm. And so you end up in these really interesting pockets where, because we've gone global, things don't work the way that we might think, where, you know, that same person has to deal with us the next day. So what's the solution? Well, blaming the user is always really, really effective. After all, I mean, let's face it, users click on things, they do things. You know, if the user didn't exist, boy, would our software be more secure. It might ruin our business model. So I'm going to talk a little bit about why our users aren't necessarily stupid. And I'm going to use a term that we've coined called scammickry. Scammickry is scam mimicry. Mark is one of my favorite scammickry submitters. Basically, scammickry is when a legitimate organization behaves in such a way that it is indistinguishable from a scam. So I'll go through some examples. By the way, you'll be seeing slides of the breaks on this. So for example, is this a scam? Anyone? Yes, no? How can you tell? How about this one? Scam, not a scam? Yes, scam, no scam, anyone?
Sure.
It is not a scam. This one?
Oh, yeah.
Very good, yep. Yes, it is. This one? It is not a scam. So you're all thinking this is really easy. So for anyone external, this is the mail. This is the website we were taken to for the services that we get. However, who sent you the link? And where did they get it? And who is the who is that this is registered to? Because it isn't Microsoft. That's who it is. How many of you ended up having to enter in your domain creds because you were not on CorpNet for this? How many of you checked the who is before you did that? Okay, yeah, awesome. So we do have a few. But if you think about it, I don't know about you, I was so excited about my Surface that it wasn't until like I actually started getting the fact that the site was busy that I even clued in that something might be up that I went and checked the who is. I was all ready to give you my domain creds. I do it for benefits all the time. There are all these cases where it's really, really hard for people to tell the difference. I encourage you, during the breaks, there will be slides. So if you're not feeling social, take a look. There are, is it a scam, is it not a scam, and it will tell you, along with a bunch of other information about the conference. But it's one of these things, we've been collecting these, and it's a hard problem. I mean, a lot of the things that we want to do as a business kind of do look like scams. But because of this, it isn't really fair for us to take a look at our users and say, oh, you know, the problem is you clicked on that thing. The problem is you gave that person your creds. So what should customers do? You know, they get some kind of crazy email. Well, you can always use my solution, which is I have told my parents to email me. I have actually had my family, in order to not get malware, just send me all of their interesting scams, and it turns out they get lots of them. My solution is to email them back always with, yes, it's a scam. So far, I have not ended up with them losing any major actual business opportunities, so all has been well. But we don't really have a lot of tools for users. I mean, we have some, you know, information out there about common scams and stuff, but it's actually a really, really hard problem for users. So what do our customers actually do? So I've included a little piece of data here where half of U.S. adults report that they are concerned. These are all actual emails that have been sent in to secure@microsoft.com over the last few months. The one that really got me, I think I've been the victim of a scam. Somebody fell for the phone scam and lost, what is it, 125 pounds, which is, you know, a significant amount of money for, you know, taking a phone call and thinking that you're doing the right thing. So what can it mean for our business? There's direct financial loss to the business. This can be things like people signing up for a whole bunch of free trials and then utilizing those services and using as many as they can, and fundamentally we don't get the money for them. The credit card numbers that they used to sign up were stolen. It can also mean things like fundamentally using stolen credit cards to get goods and services from us. We end up usually refunding the money to the user, and so, or if we can charge it, you know, if we can charge it all, in which case it is a direct hit on our business. Fines from credit card companies. When I got into fraud and abuse, I didn't know previously that credit card companies, when we as a vendor work with them, or anyone as a vendor works with them, pretty much caps at a certain number the amount of fraud that you can have. And any more chargebacks, which are when you basically get charged for, you know, that you tried to charge something and it gets returned, when it goes over that, you start incurring fines that can go into the millions of dollars. And so if you don't have good systems for fraud prevention in place, it can start costing your business, in addition to the losses, a significant amount of money. Reputation costs and bad press. You know, we've all seen what happens when there's like a big data breach, or when, you know, a site is hosting a bunch of stuff that people don't like, or, you know, customers are being harmed. I'll talk a little bit later how Xbox ended up getting a bunch of bad press because of some fraud that was happening for them. Difficulties in real customers using the service. If a bunch of fraudsters are busy using up all the cycles of a service, you can't really get to it. When I got the Surface email yesterday, my first concern was, wow, if that site's busy, I wonder how many attacks they're getting. You know, I wonder how many people outside of Microsoft are trying to see if they can either DDoS the site or if they can sign up for a Surface by basically overloading the servers. Direct harm to the customer. You know, there are cases where, you know, a customer goes and signs up for something with us, and, you know, the next thing you know, their credit card's being charged, and, you know, not everyone has enough space on their credit card such that it's okay that they have a couple extra $1,000 while we're investigating the situation. If that credit card gets shut down, that may be something that they're depending on. It may be that somebody gets into their accounts and starts, you know, deleting their email because it makes it harder for people to catch the account's been compromised. They may have their account compromised and they can't run their business. And when these things happen, people get a bad taste in their mouth and they move on. Regulation. I'll talk a bit more about this later on too, but, you know, with the, you know, the cybersecurity bills, they're actually across the world, many different governments looking at how do we go and regulate around this space. There are losses of business opportunities where people are afraid. I talked to a graduate student who they had been using Dropbox for all of their data sharing because they had been using attachments previously and that was getting cumbersome, so they're like, let's try Dropbox. And then there was the Dropbox breach. Didn't end up harming them at all, but their advisors took one look at it and they're like, we want nothing to do with this. I'm like, oh great, did they go to SkyDrive? No, they went to attachments. They're never going back. Those advisors, as far as they're concerned, they dip their toe in the water, they're done. And loss of customer base, where people move on to different services. So I wanted to give some examples of different types of fraud. So this is piracy. This is a slide that comes out of our digital crimes unit. And these are some of the piracy sites that are out there. These are sites where, you know, either, you know, volume licensing keys have been gotten and given out, you know, are basically being resold. Various different ways where people acquire software or make copies. Sometimes those copies have malware in them too as an extra benefit. Sometimes they don't. But these are all cases where, in many cases, really legitimate, you know, customers who want to be legitimate customers get tricked into getting products that they don't want, and suddenly they're not genuine, they have all these issues. I've had cases like I've ordered things off eBay and found out that they were, you know, that they were fakes. And it's like, okay, what do I do about this? I meant to be a legitimate customer. Do I return it? Like, there are plenty, and I happen to notice a difference. There are plenty of these cases where people would happily pay for the real software. They just don't know that they're not getting it. What are some other things that have happened? I mentioned the UW breach. There's been a huge IRS breach in South Carolina. So people just trying to do the right thing and do their taxes, their social security numbers have now been leaked. And then, of course, we all know about the India store. And, you know, the India store, basically, you know, it came down to, there was a lot of bad press about, you know, can Microsoft really store passwords? Can you really trust them? Another reason why we care. Let's face it, we're a devices and services company. That's what's, you know, Ballmer said this year in our big meeting, and we are now looking at devices and services. But people are afraid. I mean, you're basically being told, like, don't do your banking on your phone, be really careful of your phone. You know, your phone is your, you know, is now your backup auth also for your Microsoft account. So, you know, it's like, do you trust your phone? Do you not trust your phone? And a lot of people are afraid of things like online shopping and other cloud services because they don't know if they're real or fake. They don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of fear out there. And so our ability to succeed around cloud services and around devices means making sure that our customers feel secure enough to do what they want to do online. And that means both prevention of fraud and abuse, and it also means helping our customers recover in a way that they can move forward. So I'm gonna go into a little side story. Somebody once told me, they're like, oh yeah, no, everybody's always going to be online. This is my incredibly awesome grandmother. She still pressure washes her house, even though she just turned 89. She cooks, she travels, she does all sorts of things. She is one of the most amazing people I know. She's also the person that has those AARP bulletins, like things all over her house that tell you how to be safe. If you call her, there's a male voice on the answering machine so that, you know, it doesn't appear that she's a woman living alone. She does all these things to make sure that she is safe. And Grandma has been watching the news. And so she knows I work in cybersecurity, don't worry, but she watches the news and she's like, you've got to be kidding. So she looked at me one day, she's like, I looked and she says, dial-up. And I'm like, wow, you have dial-up. I didn't know we had dial-up still. And she's like, well, I'm afraid that if my computer's always attached to the internet, something could come down on it when I'm not looking. And like, I went to giggle. I did. And then I'm like, wait, I happen to know people who do that. I know people who walk around with, you know, wireless antennas, basically putting things down on your computer when you're not looking, you know? There's a whole bunch of things that aren't happening. You know, Matt Honan will be talking tomorrow. She's not going to lose the last 18 months of all of her pictures because they're on paper. And so, you know, yes, it could happen. There could be a fire or something like that, but she's certainly not going to lose them online. A bunch of things she's actually avoiding. She's also avoiding a really important thing. For one, every time I visit, I have to print out all the pictures of my daughter because she isn't online. Her healthcare isn't online, which at 89 means that the management that we have to do is incredible. She doesn't have Amazon, she doesn't have grocery delivery, things like that, you know. She's busy still like carrying home like, you know, big bags of dog food. She's 89, we're like, maybe you should get that delivered. And she doesn't do online banking, which has benefits, but it also makes it harder for her to make sure that she isn't a victim of scams. There's another problem too. Now granted, you know, this is only one person, but grandma isn't spending money online at all. You know, she's not spending money at Microsoft, at Amazon, at Google. She's not spending money for anyone at this point. She's not being advertised to. All of these things that our business model depend on, she is not our customer because fundamentally, she is scared half to death about being online. So now I'm going to go into a little bit of a story time. So Xbox Live. A couple years ago, Xbox Live started taking a look at some of the fraud that they had. And they're like, wow, we have a bunch of people who are going in, they're creating brand new Xbox Live accounts, they're using a stolen credit card, they're buying a whole bunch of points, and then they're selling those points. And there are some ways where you can sell points, where you can basically, you know, make an account like a child account and then not a child account, or transfer between accounts, all of which are legitimate scenarios in many cases. You know, you're trying to consolidate accounts and those sorts of things. So Xbox Live looked at this and said, great. We will get much smarter about making sure that people aren't creating basically these bogus accounts and adding stolen credit cards to them. So we'll do things like see how long the account's been online and do some limitation and some throttling. It'll be easy. They put these things into place, and the next thing you know, account compromise. So it turns out that after a while, it became easier to take over an existing person's account than it was to create a new account. So like, no problem. All of a sudden, we have customers all over whose Xbox Live accounts are being taken over. In some cases, so that you could use the payment instrument that was already on them. In some cases, so that somebody could add a payment instrument. But note also that your Xbox Live account is rather tied to if you have a Hotmail account or potentially your Health Vault account or a whole bunch of other things. And so the customer harm in these cases went way up, where before it was like, okay, well, yes, there were stolen credit cards, and you know, but Microsoft refunded the money. This was, wait, I can't get into my account. I can't play Xbox. I can't get to my email. I can't do all these things. And we started getting calls. We started getting a lot of calls. We formed a big team. We put more work on customer support. We did all these things internally. But when the press would call us, we were very clear. We have not had a breach. We have not had any technical issues here. Xbox Live is fine. You can trust that there has not been a breach. Turns out customers do not like being told, it's not our problem, it's not our problem, it's not our problem. When I went and talked to Xbox, I've been talking to them off and on, but checked in recently, they're like, if we want to tell people one thing, it's while you do need to be very, very careful about how much liability you could put yourself at risk for, telling your customers it's not your fault or that it's all their fault is not particularly helpful. Customers don't like to hear that, and they complain, a lot. So customers started complaining, you know, my account's been compromised, I'm having to wait days and days and days, you know, the reset's going to take forever, I can't play, all over the press. And finally, we decided that maybe this whole, like, it's not our problem, you know, yes, we'll throw resources at it, but it's not our problem, wasn't working. And Alex Garden, who is the GM of Xbox Live, took over Major Nelson's blog, said, hey, you know what? Just because there wasn't a breach doesn't mean that this isn't hard on customers. You know, it's a little comfort to our members that their accounts have been compromised through other means. And we don't take this lightly. We know that, you know, our customer base is the key and that their loyalty is important. And he actually ended it with, and you can personally email me. And to this day, he still gets emails We were able to take down, you know, to cut down the amount of time that it took for customers to get through. But fraud and abuse means detecting things. It means prevention. It means mitigation. It means PR. It means figuring out a plan forward. It means recovery. It means all of these different things once your service is live. You know, unlike the box products that I certainly came to work on when I first came here, we don't just get to ship it and call it good and then hope there's an SE team somewhere. Making sure that fraud prevention is in place and responding is a key part of any of our businesses. So another case. Coke gets hacked and doesn't tell anyone. We all know about the breaches that have been really public. You know, named tons and tons of companies that have had breaches that have become rather well known. But there are lots and lots of breaches at this point that aren't well known. This was a case where Coca-Cola was planning on doing a deal with the Chinese juice company. They had a bunch of people get into their systems, and while Coca-Cola has not officially said that the reason that the deal was not done is because of this, there is a significant amount of information that shows that it is most likely that the fact that the information about the potential deal got, you know, the fact that information got out is why the deal was shut off. You know, you could say, well, you know, they should be more careful, it's no big deal. But if you look at this last item out of the three big pieces, the Securities and Exchange Commission last year said that companies are required to report any material losses from such attacks. So the government's looking at this and saying, hey, you know what? I think your stockholders would want to know about these things. From what we have seen, the stock usually actually doesn't dump much. It goes down a little and comes right back up. But as Mark talked about a little bit, governments are starting to look into the fact that, you know, this is something that may actually need to be regulated, that we need to make sure that people are sharing their information about breaches. And so one of the things that we will be looking for is, first of all, what's the right information for us to be sharing about breaches anyway to protect our customers? But also, you know, how will we respond to worldwide requests for the information that's going to get out? So it's early. We need games. And I brought neat glasses. So for those of you who haven't seen it, and this will also be in the slide deck between groups, NEAT is our official advice on usable security warnings. Usable security warnings are part of how customers prevent fraud and abuse. Basically, if they're able to make good security decisions, their chances of being social engineered are less. Our advice is to make sure that that your dialogue is necessary, that you're not asking questions if the computer could figure out a better answer, that you're explaining to the user, that the advice is actionable, that they can make a good decision in both positive and malicious circumstances, and that you test that data. Neat, of course, makes an amazing juice glass, and so because everyone should drink their orange juice neat, and so because of that, we have neat glasses, which I'll give out. So, and I will actually start the Q&A during the puzzles, most likely, because I have a feeling some of these might take you a little bit of time. So the first one. So I've read through some really awesome password advice. It says things like make sure you don't use words out of the dictionary. If you use passphrases, of course, mix that up too, so it's not just dictionary words. Use long passwords, change them regularly, never repeat passwords, don't write your passwords down. And there have been many talks at security conferences this year on the applications that people use to store all their passwords, how those have had issues as well. So I have a little memory challenge. You can take photographs of this for now, but during the challenge, you cannot use photographs or written. I'd like anyone who believes they can to come up here or to the when we're doing Q&A mics. Close your eyes and recite all five passwords. Note that this is only five. I have over 100 passwords. And so if you think about, like, this is like the world's easiest user. Like, this is grandma using. We all have many, many more. Now, you might be saying, well, you know, I don't have to worry about this because I just use a weak password for all those, you know, sites I don't care about. And then I just use these, so I only have a few. It turns out that, you know, if I subscribe to the New York Times, they have my billing address, they have my credit card number, and they might even have some secret question information. How many other companies will take that as proof of identity? Quite a few, because that's all the information they have on me either. And so it turns out that this becomes a scenario we have to follow. So do I have any people who are at least going to try this? Anybody believe they can do it? No one. I actually expected at least one person with a photographic memory to be able to do this. All right, well, if you want to take a photograph of it and try it, find me later and do this. I will happily give you a neat glass. The next one, secret questions. I decided to use myself because using anyone else seemed mean. I have 5 glasses, 1 for each of these 5, if you can find this information out about me. I should mention that all of these questions are questions that a financial institution lists as possible secret questions. And I have a feeling you'll find them pretty quickly, at least in some cases. So I did a little search for myself, made sure that they're all findable, and they are. So I'll go ahead and start Q&A while some of you are busy trying to figure out this information. And let me know if you need like my full spelling or anything to figure it out.